Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast where we talk about new books in media and communication. I am your host, Marcy Maserato. With me today is Aaron Tugendhat, author of the book, The Idols of Isis. Aaron, so happy to have you. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Marcy.
So to start, I would like, as our listeners would, I'm sure, to know a little bit more about your educational background and your professional background and what you're currently up to.
Sure. So my educational background is really a mix. And one of the exciting things about this book project was that I finally found a way for all the different parts to somehow come together. And it was somewhat miraculous, actually. So back in college, I was an art history major, and that comes into the book. I also spent some time studying the history of philosophy and especially political philosophy, history of political thought. And I eventually got my PhD in Assyriology, in ancient Near Eastern studies. And so I have worked a lot on the ancient Near East, and also I've been interested in the history of the discipline in the study of the ancient Near East since the 19th century. And so all of those things sort of come together in the book.
That's great. So you definitely have this interdisciplinary background that comes together beautifully. And I think that your book really speaks to that, which is great. This is very personal to you. So perhaps let's start there. And what inspired you to write this book specifically?
Sure. So the personal part of the book is the fact that the book, though it really moves between a lot of material from antiquity all the way up to today, the contemporary social media and such. All three of the chapters do kind of focus on Iraq, and the whole book is inspired or was prompted by an event that took place in Iraq and this destruction in the Mosul Museum in Iraq. And for me, that had a personal element because I'm Iraqi on my mother's side. My grandfather was from Baghdad and belonged to the Jewish community in Iraq that had been there presumably since antiquity. And so I didn't really know him all that well. He died when I was very young. And so this was a way for me to reconnect with that part of my own heritage in certain ways.
That's great. And in terms of what's the academic side of it, mm-hmm. you talk about that kind of, you know, infamous video that was published where ISIS was destroying these really ancient symbols. So you're really, a lot of the, I think the, throughout your book, you really talk about iconoclasm and idolatry. So can you talk about how that particular video, as you mentioned in your prologue, how did that really sit with you on a personal level, on an academic level, that really propelled you to say, hey, I really got to write about this?
Right. So when I saw the video for the first time, I saw it, I think, like many people on social media, on Facebook, and because of this background that I have in ancient Near Eastern studies, I had, you know, many of my colleagues had posted it. So I didn't only see it once, I saw it repeatedly on my feed. And I watched it, and the very early on, I noticed a similarity, which I found rather uncanny, between one scene that has often been reproduced of three men with sledgehammers smashing the sculpture of a king in the museum in Mosul. And it's this resemblance that it has to a relief sculpture from the ancient Assyrian palace of Sargon II at Khorsabad, which is only about 25 kilometers away from Mosul. But of course, this image was made 2,500 years earlier than the video. And that palace relief also shows three men with sledgehammers smashing the sculpture of a king. And, you know, that image is decently known among experts in ancient Near Eastern studies. I knew about it, and it came immediately to my mind because I had in the past curated an exhibition on idolatry called Idol Anxiety, and then co-edited a volume of essays on the same topic with the same title, Idol Anxiety. And when I was looking for an image to put on the cover of that book, I decided on this relief from ancient Assyria. So I was very familiar with the relief, though actually in the book Idol Anxiety, though I have an introduction there where I talk quite a bit about the ancient Near East, I don't actually talk about that image at all. It's just literally was just chosen for the cover. And so here was an opportunity to actually make good on actually thinking about what that image is all about and thinking about the relationship between that image and the ISIS video image, and more generally, right, about the nature of iconoclasm, the politics of iconoclasm, and importantly, and this is a real important feature of the book, that not only the destruction of images, but the making of images of that destruction, and how iconoclasm itself is a form of image making. And both, and that's the case both with respect to the palace relief and with the case with respect to the video by ISIS. And so that's a theme that runs throughout the book.
Yeah, and you split up this book in, because it's really it's so much information in very short form, which I thought was really fascinating, but you make it very clear because you have essentially three large sections that you talk about. So you really start that conversation by looking at idols, and then you look at the museum as an institution that stores these idols, and then you look at videos and how videos in the new media sphere, as you just mentioned, can recreate this sense of iconoclasm, and what does that really mean, particularly in the context of what ISIS does with these videos, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so go ahead.
Yeah, please. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, please, you.
No, so I'm curious to contextualize that further, and we can perhaps start as you mentioned in the book with the idols, and what does that really mean in relation to, because you do a great job contextualizing it and connecting this particular video, as you mentioned earlier, with the antiquity and that history of like, wow, we really need to look at some really ancient history and complex history at that, about the relationship, particularly in Iraq, with idols and with icons.
Yeah. So as you said, right, the three chapters progress from idols, which is the term that the spokesman in the video uses to identify the objects that are being destroyed. And so the first chapter is one where I'm really kind of probing what ISIS itself claims to be doing, or what they claim these objects to be. And I do that extensively by using the philosophical thought of the medieval Islamic philosopher Abu Nasr al-Farabi, who, though not originally from Iraq, was working, sort of flourishing in Baghdad at the height of sort of medieval Baghdad. And so that's how that chapter sort of centers around Iraq. As I was saying, like each chapter in a way kind of centers around Iraq in different periods, medieval, ancient medieval and modern, though not in that order. And so part of that chapter, right, and if we're talking especially about media and theory of media, I suppose one of the things I would want to say is that I think al-Farabi is a very important media theorist. And if this book can somehow put al-Farabi on the map of valuable media theorists to be reading and thinking about, then I'd be very pleased by that, right? So to think that it's not only, obviously, contemporary thinkers that belong in that group of people that we should be thinking about when we're thinking about the complexity of media. And then the second chapter called Museums, partly it's about taking a step back, sort of widening the scope, right? And saying, well, they're saying that they're destroying these idols, but really what they're destroying are these objects in museum, or not really, but in addition, right, that these are objects in a museum, and these are objects that when they're calling them idols, the sort of UNESCO and other and museums throughout the world, right, are saying that this is heritage and that these are heritage properly belonging in a museum. And so the second chapter is really about exploring what that is all about, and doing so by telling a much more complicated story about the different ways these objects have been given meaning by being placed in different museums in different parts of the world since the rediscovery in the mid 19th century, right? And so what does it mean for these objects to be in a museum in France or in London or in Baghdad, and the complicated stories that are involved in all of that? And I try to really show that there are multiple strands that need to be taken into account. And then finally, the chapter on videos, which is to say, well, this is not just about the destruction of these objects or the placement of these objects in a museum, but rather the making of a new image. And that in that chapter, ultimately that chapter becomes a comparison of the production of images of image destruction along with other images in the Assyrian palace on the one hand, and today, and social media. And I focus specifically on Facebook because that's where I first discovered the image myself, the video myself, right? And so I think it's safe to say that chapter is the first time that there's been a sustained comparison of between the structure of the ancient Assyrian palace and the structure of a social media platform. And it was a lot of fun to try and think about those two things together.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun reading that. I have to say, I mean, I very much enjoyed the book, and as somebody who's done a lot of studies in video art, the videos I'm you know, and I teach media, so I was just really fascinated by, you know, you start with talking about futurist F.T. Marinetti, which shows up in my dissertation work a lot. So I definitely it spoke to me in many, many ways. So I think it's awesome, and we'll dive deeper into all of these chapters. So starting with the idols, you speak a lot about Ibrahim and Nimrud's regime, and you give us the context of those, the space that they occupy, the political space that they occupied, the differences in their approach to that, and then how that really seems to conflict with what ISIS is doing. So can you talk a little bit more about that in terms of the context of how you develop that argument?
Sure. So first of all, one thing just to say generally, right, is that another line that runs throughout the book is really thinking about the role of images in politics, the relationship between images and politics, and how I think we can hopefully, how we might be able to generate a kind of more sophisticated, a better, healthier understanding of images, and how that's important, I think, for our own contemporary political situation. And that's why I end ultimately with social media, which is, of course, where today we're encountering more and more images. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But to go back, as you're asking about the first chapter with respect to idols. So the video, the ISIS video begins, or there's a sort of introductory section. And then there's one moment where one line from the Quran appears on screen. And it's just a couple of words taken from the story of Ibrahim, the young Ibrahim, or Abraham, same figure, who as a lad decided to smash the idols or the sculptures, statues of his townsfolk, right, his neighbors. And he's eventually brought before the king, King Nimrod, who in Islamic imagination is identified in a way with all of the kind of major imperial, like those empires of the ancient Near East, right? So the Syrians, the Babylonians. So in a medieval imaginary, Nimrod sort of stands in for all of those pre-Islamic empires. And so there's this kind of staged combat or kind of combat of wits, really, between the young Ibrahim, who destroys these images or idols, and actually the word is interchangeable in the text, and Nimrod. And what's interesting, and this is where I'm trying to bring out the political ramifications of this material, is that the images are identified as Nimrod's images, and they're identified as belonging to the regime that Nimrod has established, and that they play a role in sort of maintaining and defining the ideals and the contours of Nimrod's regime. And so what's really at stake here is it's not just a religious issue. If today, because of a whole bunch of different, you know, things that we've inherited since the early modern period, that we might think of religion as somehow separate from politics. But here, the real question is, who should be ruling, or who should we as human beings serve? And do we serve Nimrod, this king, who rules by means of these images? Or do we serve God, the creator of everything, according to Ibrahim, who has to be served directly without any mediation by images of humanly made images? And so the whole story is really about the problem of mediation, the problem of humanly made images that serve this form of mediation, but are therefore, because they're humanly made, they're not true. The question and these questions of politics. And I mean, ultimately, like I said, I bring in Al-Farabi to try to argue that Ibrahim's desire or call for a regime without images, right? The idea that we could live as a political community serving God without any images as intermediaries is actually a mistake. It's a failure to understand the necessities that go with political life. And this is sort of that I use Al-Farabi for saying that images are necessary to give us some type of shared communal understanding so that we can ultimately love the law and sort of identify as a political community. And so to say that we want to just reject images, destroy images because they're false, is in a sense a kind of attempt to run away from the necessities of politics, the mess of politics, and I'm trying to make an argument in that section that this is a mistake, that one needs to accept our situation that needs these images. If I may add just one last thing there, just to show how kind of complicated it is, you know, it's one thing to say that within the story, this lad, Ibrahim, says, well, we need to have a regime without images. So within the story, I would say that that Ibrahim is naive. That doesn't mean that the story of Ibrahim smashing the images is naive, because the story itself, whether in the form of just a narrative or in its visual depictions, and there are visual depictions of this episode in the Quran, that's an image. The image of smashing images is an image that can serve to orient a political community in the way that Farabi is talking about. And it's proven to be a very, very powerful one. And the question is, so what kind of an image it is, and what kind of alternative images might we choose to have in orienting our politics? And these are sort of questions that I try to get onto the table in the text.
Yeah, and you make mention in this chapter, for example, that the spokesman in the video actually inaccurately identifies the images under attack. Mm-hmm. And that is, well, that's a big deal that he just completely misidentified them. And then you start making some connections in relation to looking at some contemporary adversaries. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And what does that really mean in relation to tying these two kind of contemporary ideas of iconoclasm with the antiquity that you were just speaking of?
Right. So, I mean, I wouldn't make too much of the misidentification, right? Like it's not so bad. I mean, I don't think that the spokesman had a PhD in archaeology or ancient Near Eastern studies, right? And so the objects are not actually Sumerian, but they're Assyrian and somewhat later period stuff too. You know, it's okay. You know, I think that that's not the most important. What's important, right, is that he's identifying them. I mean, again, from his perspective, and I think here we can go with this. He's identifying them as objects that belong to the civilizations that predated Islam. And in that sense, that they belong to the Jahiliyyah, the so-called age of ignorance, which in Islamic tradition is sort of what one identifies as the period before Islam. But one of the things I think this is might be what you were referring to. Towards the end of that chapter, I do tie this to certain thinkers, especially Sayyid Qutb, one of the main intellectual voices of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the 20th century, who develops a sort of idea of this idea of jahiliya or age of ignorance as not simply being a temporal matter, right? Not simply being a historical period prior to the arrival of the prophet, but as a kind of constantly available alternative to an Islamic way of life. And so therefore, this kind of age of ignorance is still with us today in different forms, and is, from the perspective of someone like Qutb, to be fought against. And so what I think is interesting in the video is that these objects that are literally from the historical Jahiliyyah, right, the historical period before the advent of Islam, come to also take on a kind of symbolic value as objects that are idolized, we might even say, right, by modern jahiliya, right? So the spokesperson calls them idols, and at one level that means that presumably he's saying that these were objects that in antiquity people worshipped, right? Whether or not that's true,
right?
But there's that claim. But on top of that, he's also saying that here this is a museum, and these objects are being put in a museum, and they're fitting into the way of thinking that undergirds the modern museum. And that modern way of thinking, says someone like Qutb, right, is a form of jahiliya. And so these objects then take on that other meaning as well, right? So I think you get this sort of doubleness going on.
And this really brings us into the next chapter, into the museums, and you bring up Carol Duncan's book, Civilizing Rituals, looking at museums as quintessentially modern sites for, quote, publicly representing beliefs about the order of the world, its past, its present, and the individual's place within it, unquote. And really your question becomes, what is the significance about this video taking place at a museum? So let's unpack that a little bit. Sure. In relation to perhaps we can start a little bit more macro and looking at what museums really represent in that greater sphere of being a site of of idols and iconoclasm.
Right. So, I mean, first of all, I would say that Duncan's point in a way is actually deeply Al-Farabian, whether or not she's aware of that. In the sense of how these images are working to form certain types of political identities. What's different, and just to add this element, because I think that this is where things get complicated and difficult for us, right, is that in Al-Farabi's medieval philosophical scheme, he talks about a prophet, and that it's the role of the prophet to provide the appropriate images for any particular political community and to orient, and the prophet is able to do this because the prophet is so wise, is able to therefore choose the appropriate images to orient that community in a way that the community can flourish. That's a kind of lovely, okay, idealized picture, very also, right, you know, top down. Now, what to do with it from our more, say, democratic perspective, right? And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, well, Farabi's point that we need these images in order to hold a political community together remains true if we actually want to be flourishing political communities, but we don't have prophets that we can outsource this activity to, right? And so we, in a way, we become both the makers and the users or recipients of the images. And that means that we need to be able to judge between different possibilities, right? And so so here, going to the museum, the point of developing these kind of multiple parallel stories in the story in the chapter on museums is to say that, well, no, Duncan is right about how museums function, but I don't think she would disagree with this, but there actually is a multiplicity of ways that museums can produce these types of communal or political identities. There's not just one way, right? And so the chapter tries to use this just as a case study, this one set of objects, these one set of objects that have been dug out of the ground from in Iraq over the last 150 years or so, and see what are the many, many different ways that just this one small set of objects have been able to be used to produce different kinds of identities or different types of political belongings, not only because they're being placed in museums in different parts of the world, right? So obviously one big distinction here is between how these images might operate in a museum in Iraq versus in a collection in the Louvre or in the British Museum, right? But it's not only that. First of all, like, even between the Louvre and the British Museum, there are differences. I tried also, sure, the fact that the Ottoman Empire gets involved in this at certain points. And so what does it mean for the objects to be in a museum in Istanbul, which is not quite the same as it being in London, but it's also not the same as it being in Mosul or Baghdad. And I also tried to track the many different positions within the relatively short modern history of Iraq itself, right? That's not at all just one story. And so that's really in not very many pages, I'm trying to really get a reader to recognize how wide a range of different possibilities one can get. And in a sense, this is like most of the book, this is really just as a way of using a case study to get us to think about these issues more generally and get us to become more attuned to how this would work in other places as well, right? It's not only about Iraq. It's certainly not only about ISIS, but it's using this as a way to think about these phenomena.
And so do you really think that this is goes back to this idea of context, like cultural context, geographical context, historical context, and perhaps even personal context with what somebody brings into the museum? As there's like a cartoon depicting, you know, one of the, for example, with ISIS coming in, this is my first time in a museum. This was awesome. This idea that there was the first time that they came in and they destroyed it. So how much do you think that these kind of different contexts really play a part in our relationships or societal relationships with museums across the world?
I think a lot. I mean, I think that, I suppose the main fundamental point here, right, is that if the first chapter, the core takeaway of the first chapter is that if we want to live political lives, we have to accept that images are going to play a role in them, right? We can't live without images if we're going to live political lives. And that, and I guess the corollary of that is that with Farabi, I agree that like we need to, we should want to live political lives, that our lives are better that way. The point then of the second chapter perhaps could be, you know, and it, again, sort of, on its own, it's sort of a simple, almost obvious point, but then I try to elaborate it with the actual stuff of the case study. The point would be that no image has it a meaning intrinsic to it, right? So context and the whole, I mean, depends on what we mean exactly by context, but sure, if we want, we can use the word context as a sort of speak broadly, right? That meanings accrue to objects; they're contested, and it's a much more complicated thing that we can't. That there is no single meaning that can be identified as true to an object. And I suppose the reason what set me off on this in the second chapter, right, was that it, just as the spokesperson for ISIS was saying, these objects have a set meaning. They are idols, right? And that they are about false worship, and therefore they must be destroyed, right? And that it's set in them. Well, likewise, when you know, the director general of UNESCO is saying that these are heritage, right? These are, you know, world heritage or human heritage or Iraqi heritage, and it's shifted back and forth, but that you can, that they have an obvious meaning that is that's embedded in them, right? That is natural to them. And I'm trying to say in the chapter, right, that that's actually not the case, right? That it's much more complex than that, and that context is always playing a role, and that we have to become much more nuanced in these things, right? It's not necessarily wrong for us to want to treat them as Iraqi heritage or as human heritage, but those are choices that we make. And in making those choices, we're also rejecting other possibilities, right? And I think it's really important to become aware of what choices we're rejecting and why we might be choosing one rather than the other, right? Rather than treat things as if the choice that we're making is actually not a choice because it's intrinsic to the object itself.
Right. And you you move this conversation into perhaps a bit more contextualizing, a bit more contemporary, where you bring in Saddam Hussein and looking at him as he's certainly a political figure and how he has become part of various different art pieces. So can you talk a little bit more about that and how that relates to your overall argument about this idea of idols and museums and representation and mediated representation and the power of images in politics?
Sure. So in order to give a little bit of context on that, let me take a step back because your listeners might not know so much about the history of Iraq and these things. So there are, I mean, I go even before the establishment of the state of Iraq, but if we start, say, with the establishment of the state of Iraq in 1929 and the situation with King Faisal, who was not from Iraq and sort of was kind of handed Iraq to be his kingdom after a failed attempt to be the king of Syria, and the French decided to get rid of him, and so he became available, and so the British were like, all right, well, why don't we put him in Iraq instead? And Iraq was a very diverse place, and it wasn't entirely clear how you would hold these diverse populations together in a kind of nation state that had never existed in this kind of modern sense of a nation state before. And one thing that was kind of, you know, more or less true about all of the territory now being ruled by Faisal was that these objects were fairly prevalent, right? That you could find these ancient Mesopotamian sculptures throughout this region. And so it made a certain amount of sense to try and attach a kind of new modern Iraqi identity to this ancient material and this ancient heritage, and now identify this, right, as Iraq's ancient heritage, which now the modern state is connected to. I should say, by the way, right, that that was not just universally accepted at the time. First of all, there were objections from people who, or from Muslims who wanted to put more emphasis on Islam, against this kind of pagan pre-Islamic past. But it was also, in a way, perhaps more interestingly, because we wouldn't think about it maybe today as much. Arab nationalists, and this was kind of where Faisal was coming from in his own ideology, Arab nationalists were saying, well, no, like, our goal is to kind of create a kind of united Arab identity, and these objects might be available here in Iraq, but they aren't widely available throughout the Arab world, which extends far beyond Iraq, and that therefore to focus on these objects would be to sort of separate Iraq out from the project of a more trans-Arab identity, right? And so these are the kinds of tensions that I'm trying to bring out in the book to sort of get us aware about how complicated these decisions are. And eventually Faisal nevertheless pushes forward with the establishment of the Iraq Museum, etc., and which will house these objects. So that's sort of using the past, the ancient past, in a sort of important but relatively light way, as if we compare it to then Saddam Hussein years later, who was, you know, he did everything on a grand scale, and he loved using the ancient Mesopotamian past. And so some of my favorite images reproduced in the book, right? And, you know, it's a fairly, for such a short book, I mean, I think that there are quite a few wonderful images that I bring in there. The whole book kind of operates as a kind of image essay as well. Some of my favorite images are the ones of Saddam Hussein, right? Saddam Hussein in placing himself in the guise of an ancient Assyrian king fighting off the lions, which he then also ties to the war against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war, because of the sense that there was there were kind of parallels, sort of Assyria had been attacked in antiquity from peoples from the Iranian plateau. And so they were, so he sort of uses that as a kind of way to sort of say that he's a reincarnation of the ancient Assyrian kings. And he does this also with Babylonians and others. And so he makes it entirely his own. He puts a lot of money into excavations and into museums and rebuilding museums and, you know, really a patron of this material, but always with his own twist, always with a stamp, right? So it's always, when he rebuilt parts of Babylon, he rebuilt walls and had bricks stamped with, in cuneiform, statements of talking that mentioned Saddam Hussein, like the great king Saddam Hussein, just in the same way as the Babylonian kings used to do, right? And so he really muddies or the boundary between history or antiquity and the contemporary situation.
It is fascinating that you bring him in, and there are these really powerful, wonderful images throughout your book, which really, for those of us who may not be familiar with some of these pieces, it definitely helps kind of visually contextualize, especially because you are talking about the images, right? So I think that's great. And as we move into chapter 3, where you're really looking at, you know, recording a destructive act, the video itself becomes a kind of replacement image.
Exactly.
So it's, you know, the destruction of images, as you mentioned, the book then becomes part of image production, which is like a really loaded statement in terms of how, you know, there's a lot there and how we can look at that. So let's talk about that in relation to the video and what that really means in when we're looking at the museum institution and we're looking at idols and this, and of course this particular video that came out from ISIS in 2015.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot to say there. First of all, this idea that image destruction doesn't actually very often just exist on its own, but it's actually about or involved in the production of new images is, I think, very important, and it's not, and it's by no means limited to the case, as I already mentioned, of the Assyrian palace relief that shows the three men with sledgehammers or the ISIS video. There's a long tradition, and you know, an early draft of the book included a lot more material, which I then actually cut because it just started going. Going too far, but you know, I think people might be familiar with images from the Protestant Reformation. Very often, like you get a book on Protestant iconoclasm, for example, right? And the book will have a bunch of these images, and they'll present the images as if they are depictions of the iconoclasm, just sort of, you know, evidence of the iconoclasm without really thinking about the fact that that these are images, right, themselves,
right,
of the iconoclasm, and sort of not. And so I really wanted to bring that home and really think about what does it mean to make these images, because first of all, it's a sign, right, that it's not actually, for all that the rhetoric might be about escaping images, it's never really about escaping images. It's always about what I would call regime change, replacing one set of images with a new set of images. And so that's one point. Another point, which is important, and this is true both for the Assyrian palace reliefs and for the ISIS videos, right, is that these images of image destruction don't exist alone. They often are part of a larger set of images. So the image of iconoclasm is only one of a whole set of images. That's in the case of the Assyrian palace relief. I talk about how that one part with the three men with sledgehammers, right, is only a small segment of a much larger panel and then a much larger relief program within the palace room, right? And so you have to think about what work that image is doing, what political work that image is doing in relationship to the other images on the wall. And of course, that's also the case with ISIS, right? So the book is focused on the video of iconoclasm. But as we all know, around the same time that this video came out in 2015, the internet was being flooded with other videos, many probably more familiar to a wider group of people because more gruesome, right? These images of executions, for example. But then there were also videos of the healthcare network that ISIS was setting up and these types of things, right? There's a whole range of different videos that were being produced. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is, in a sense, how ISIS, like the Assyrian palace, was here producing a set of images to kind of decorate their own palace. But this time around, rather than it being a physical palace, right, with physical walls like at Khorsabad or these other ancient sites, it was a virtual palace that exists, you know, nowhere in particular, but rather everywhere that we look at our screens, right?
Right.
And so one of the things that I wanted to think about was, what's at stake in that shift? What's at stake in the palace walls, so to speak, moving to our screens? It's no longer called, Facebook no longer calls it your wall, right? But for those of us who are on Facebook early enough, like, it used to be called one's you posted on one's wall, right? And so even the language there is reminiscent. And so that's the main comparison. But I tried to develop an argument for how things are, it's not just the same, you know, but on the internet, but rather that there are actually significant differences that we should become aware of in terms of how the platform, right, affects the political power of images.
Yeah, and it certainly does. The platform, when we think about currently the technological platforms available to us, it's huge. And you specifically also talk about gaming, mm-hmm. and video games. And as you mentioned earlier, this idea that old images are not erased, they're recycled, which you mention in the book. And that's, and I think that I agree that that's an important point to make. And then you go on and really talk about how ISIS videos imitate video games that are themselves imitations of the real world.
Exactly.
So you get into this hyper real, very kind of postmodern viewpoint of images.
Yeah. So I talk about the video games. I mean, the video game part was a fun part to write. I originally tried to play some of these first person shooter video games that people had. I wasn't the first to recognize that there was some types of formal similarities between ISIS videos and first-person shooter video games. I'm not a gamer. I tried my best. I actually used research funds to buy myself a PlayStation and a copy of Call of Duty, and I couldn't get past the first board, the first thing.
Not all of us are gamers. Yeah, exactly. I'm with you on that. I've tried sometimes too. Yeah.
But as it happens, at the time I had a student. I was teaching at the University of Chicago at the time, and I had a student in my introductory humanities course who was a kind of professional video game player, who, you know, one of these people that plays online and gets paid for, but people pay to just watch him play first-person shooter video games. And so I took some of more of my research funds, and I hired him to play to watch these ISIS videos. I was wondering if I needed to get him to sign a release to that I was not, like, if he ended up joining ISIS, I was not going to be responsible. But
wow, that's a tough question. Yeah. Like,
I didn't actually bother to bring it to the counsel's office at the University of Chicago because I had a fear that if I mentioned it to them, right, that they would have not allowed me to hire the student to do this work. But, yeah. Anyway, he was thrilled. Like, basically the job was watch these videos that I, you know, downloaded off the internet. And I mean, side point, this is, I'm now banned from YouTube because I was downloading these videos and, you know, I wrote to them and I said, I'm an academic. I was doing this for scholarship. And they told me, we don't care.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, wow. So they were basically maybe saying that you were attempting to join ISIS?
Yeah, or something like that. Right?
Wow. So like, just some sort of,
I mean, still today, like, I cannot get onto, like, I can't have, you know, a YouTube account.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so I told him to watch these videos and then to identify places in the video games that he knew so well that were similar and to record his play. And he made these wonderful little, like, a clip of one, you know, and clip of the other, right? And so that was fun. But for me, the question that I was trying to explore there was, what does it mean to want to inhabit a video game, right? Because the idea was that the caliphate was being advertised as if, you know, as if it were a video game, as if you could actually live in the video game, right? And that led me to some interesting thoughts about what it means to be playing a game, right, where you're still outside the game versus entering into the game, which is, frankly, you're no longer playing it. You're actually being played. And so this was a fun way for me also to think about parallels between gameplay, programming of the game, the role of judgment involved, and how we don't actually how our ultimate goals are set for us in a game, and why that might be appealing, but also I think problematic that we want to outsource responsibility for our ultimate goals, and how there might even be some parallels between all of that and certain ideas about divine law. This gets much more complicated. And so anyway, this was an area that I was exploring with respect to the games. But if I may, at this point, I would say maybe even more important was the thinking about social media and algorithms. And I don't use a term in the book. I wish I had. I only thought about it after. But I would now say that the final section of that third chapter is about what I would now call algorithmic iconoclasm. And I'm just trying to explain a little bit what I have in mind, right? So if iconoclasm is ultimately about the desire to eradicate those images that we don't want to have around, that point to a kind of political orientation that we don't want, that we want to reject, right? And we want to somehow inhabit a space free of being reminded of that alternate political possibility. Well, every time we click on Facebook or on Twitter, right, and every time we click, the algorithms get to know us better. And as the algorithms get to know us better, they know what we want to see, and they know what we don't want to see, and they give us what we want to see, and they keep us from seeing what we don't want to see. And so what this actually means is that every time we click, we're engaged in a kind of iconoclasm in that we are purifying our visual world or our visual realm from the images that we don't want to see, right? And I think we all know how devastating the political consequences of that can be, because unlike in the case, say, of that ideal situation with Al-Farabi, of the prophet producing images for a unified polity. These days, here, obviously, we all know about this when we talk about echo chambers and such. Rather than images being used to produce a unified polity, right, we're clicking our way into these separate realms and separate worlds, even though, at least in at the level of citizenship, right, we are supposed to be all members of the same polity, right? I'm trying to connect this to some of the issues that, say, I'm an American, we in the United States are facing right now. To take an image from the Capitol riot on January 6th, right? We all saw many images circulate around that time. But this goes back to also the issue of context. The meaning of the images that circulated for us almost certainly, right, were limited by the by what the algorithms know about us and know what they want, right? And so even the same image, say the flying of the flag, the Confederate flag in the Senate, probably, was presented, even if we saw the same image, even if I saw the same image as the friends of the person flying that flag in the Capitol, I saw it contextualized in a certain way that it meant one thing, whereas another group would have either not seen it at all or seen it, contextualized to mean something completely different. And that's the product of this type of algorithmic iconoclasm that I would now call that. I think we should become concerned about this and start thinking about the ramifications of it.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating. I'm glad you brought that up because that was going to be my next question.
Okay.
Was looking at the the algorithm, and I was having a conversation just yesterday where you're on Instagram, and if you, depending on how long you just watch a video, an ad, they're counting that.
Yep.
You don't even need to like touch it, right? You don't have to touch your screen, but they know that you have paused for X amount of seconds.
Or microseconds,
Or microseconds, right, exactly. So, and I even tell my students, I'm like, there are things that you can do to, keep the algorithm dumb, because it doesn't start off smart. The more that we feed it, the smarter it gets.
Exactly.
In relation to what it's going to give us or whatnot. So yeah, absolutely. And I think many of us are aware that we're like, nope. So I personally do not click on the ads. I attempt to just kind of keep going, but ever so often it gets all of us, because it might be like, wow, I actually need that. Right. So, and that's what they're counting on. They're counting on that engagement. I think it's really fascinating that you're talking about this notion of iconoclasm online and in this digital platform arena of us creating our own, curating our own images in a way that, as you mentioned, in a political sphere is dangerous, because then you create this echo chamber of just the same content and the same, which is problematic, right? This is where we start getting into kind of this idea of it's cognitive dissonance in a way.
Well, I think that if we're going to live in the same polity with other people, then we need to be living in the same reality as those people. And so, like you were saying with the ads, right? Well, I think very often we think about this just in purely capitalist type sense, right? Oh, it's just about selling stuff. And it's great. I would prefer to see ads about, stylish jeans rather than ads about, whatever, right? Because it's more relevant to me. And so why not see those? But it's obviously not just about commerce. It is also having an effect on how we end up seeing the world, the fact that we're more and more seeing the world through our social media, and it's the way that we're getting access to our world. It really does make a big difference. And The problem, I think, is that there is a deep-seated human desire for our world to look the way that we want it to look, right? So it's when you say that you try and tell your students to shut off or make the algorithms dumb. I mean, the problem with that is that there are good reasons why we don't want them to be dumb, right? The smarter the algorithm is, the more satisfied we can become with the world as we see it, and we want to be living in a world that satisfies us. I think that there's a natural
convenience.
Yes. or it speaks to a kind of, right, like, oh my God, it's so wonderful that everybody agrees with me, and right, whenever I see the articulation of an idea that I don't disagree with, it's always presented as like absurd and ridiculous and ironically or something like this, right? I never actually have to see it as something that I might have to contemplate or contend with or consider as a possibility, even if I'm not going to agree with it myself, but at least maybe even something that might be a legitimate alternative that I can share a country with if a person who holds that view. I don't even have to hear about the view. It's great, right? Like, I live in this world where everybody agrees with me, such that, and that's incredibly appealing, but it's incredibly dangerous if we're going to continue to live, you know, as political in political groups, because it just sends us into this fantasy world.
Yeah, I think that to me, it just reminds me of Plato's Allegory of a Cave.
Yes,
it just how easy it is to remain looking at shadows, mm-hmm, rather than being outside of the cave, right, and really dealing with things that you don't have complete control of, such as opinions that you don't agree with.
Yeah,
or ideas that you don't agree with. Right.
And, you know, and maybe this is, you have this in mind, right? There is a reason why in the coda of the book, right, I finally do bring in the figure of Socrates, who in a sense maybe was lurking throughout the book in certain ways. And Socrates finally does make a cameo in the final section.
Yes, and I really appreciate how you do bring these, scholars and these philosophers and these ideas that kind of span many, many centuries that, to kind of make your argument, which is very robust. So definitely this is, you know, for such a short form book, there's so much in here, and the images and everything really fascinating. And I'm you know, very interested to see what else you're going to be working on. Are you currently working on anything else kind of as we wrap up? Or are you just inundated with teaching, as many of us are? What are you currently doing, Aaron?
Right. So thanks for asking. So the truth is, once I finish this book, even though it is incredibly short, as you said, it does pack a lot in, and ranging over 2,500 years in many, many disciplines, and trying to write about all of this stuff in a way that is accessible to really anyone, not assuming any expert knowledge whatsoever, because I knew I was playing between so many different expertise groups. I wanted to write a book that was available, that would be understandable and enjoyable to read to that wide range. So anyway, there a lot of work went into this short book. And so for a while, I kind of just took a step back, and I wasn't really even thinking about a next project. And so I've been doing a lot of teaching, and I teach a wide range of humanities courses here in Berlin. And one of the things that I've been thinking about at that level, so not so much scholarship, but I've come to really care about, is to think about how to expand the standard humanities curricula in more global ways. And in a sense, this book was partly an attempt of trying to bring at least the Middle East and certain traditions in European political philosophy into conversation. And so I've been thinking about that, but that's more at a pedagogical level. When I was a freshman, no, not freshman, when I was a sophomore, I transferred to the University of Chicago, and I had the good fortune of taking a class with David Green on Herodotus. Green was one of the translators of Herodotus, and you know, short Irish man, very old at the time, and he spoke to us as if Herodotus was his, you know, old friend of his. Anyway, yeah. What's the point here? I wrote a seminar paper for that class when I was a sophomore in college, and I've been sort of working on it since then. And so, I don't know, 20 years later or so, I'm thinking that I might want to finally get to work on it seriously and turn it into a book on Herodotus and cultural diversity and universal empire and the tension between those two. So we'll see if that that happens, but that's at least a possibility on the horizon.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. And you know, pedagogical goals are also great goals to have. We all have, those of us who teach full time, you know, we have to balance these two things. And after, as you mentioned, writing a book with so much, there's just chock full of so many different ideas. Sometimes taking a break from that is good as well. So
yeah, it was necessary, it'll be fun to get to the creative work of writing again, though. I love teaching, and I've had wonderful opportunities of having to be forced to learn lots of new things over the last couple of years at my position here in Berlin. And so that's been also incredibly stimulating intellectually.
That's awesome. That's great. Thank you again for joining us, Aaron. Thank you for all of our listeners for tuning in today. Until next time, cheers, everyone.
Thanks, Marcy.